Chapter 2, Finding the Sangha, The Tale of Red Rock Jewel Valley. Once the great yogi Milarepa was staying at the Eagle Castle of Red Rock Jewel Valley, absorbing himself in the practice of the Mahamudra meditation. Feeling hungry, he decided to prepare some food, but after looking about, he found there was nothing left in the cave, neither water nor fuel, let alone salt, oil, or flour. "It seems that I have neglected things too much," he said. "I must go out and collect some wood." He went out, but when he had gathered a handful of twigs, a sudden storm arose, and the wind was strong enough to blow away the wood and tear his ragged robe. When he tried to hold the robe together, the wood blew away. When he tried to clutch the wood, the robe blew apart. Frustrated, Milarepa thought, "Although I have been practicing the Dharma and living in solitude for such a long time, I am still not rid of ego clinging. What is the use of practicing Dharma if one cannot subdue ego clinging? Let the wind blow my wood away if it likes. Let the wind blow my robe off if it wishes." Thinking thus, he ceased resisting. But, due to weakness from lack of food, with the next gust of wind, he could no longer withstand the storm and fell down in a faint. When he came to, the storm was over. High up on the branch of a tree, he saw a shred of his clothing swaying in the gentle breeze. The utter futility of this world and all its affairs struck Milarepa, and a strong feeling of renunciation overwhelmed him. In the tale of Red Rock Jewel Valley, we encounter Milarepa at a comparatively early stage in his career, when his practice is still quite a struggle, and he is still more or less clothed. As we shall see, he also still possesses some books. Even so, he has evidently been practicing meditation in solitude, following the practice of Mahamudra, the union of bliss and emptiness, according to his guru's instructions, for a long time. And in this episode, his practice suddenly bears fruit through an unexpected, if apparently trivial, turn of events, of which Milarepa is able to take advantage by means of a very basic practice, mindfulness. It is clear that his practice of mindfulness is very effective, because he is so quick to observe his instinctive reaction when his robe blows apart, and to realize what that reaction implies with regard to his spiritual development. The incident is so trivial that most people, even most practicing Buddhists, wouldn't think twice about it, beyond perhaps noticing their momentary frustration at trying to do the work of three hands with two. But Milarepa is keeping a close and unremitting watch over himself, and it is the brief conflict in his mind that draws his attention to the deeper issue. Seeing beyond his frustration to the fundamental delusion underlying it, he realizes that while he is literally clinging to his robe, he is clinging to his ego just as tightly. As the wind snatches his robe from him, he observes himself possessively clinging to his meager property and says to himself, "What is making me cling to my robe in this way? It is because I feel that it is mine. It is my robe. My body needs it for covering. I need it." At once recognizing this as evidence of a still active ego, he gives up his robe to the importunate tugging of the wind. One of the best-known accounts of the Buddha's teaching of mindfulness is the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness. As one of the most important of the Pali Suttas, or discourses, this text is part of the bedrock of modern-day Theravadin practice, and its theme of mindfulness remains integral to all traditions of Buddhism. Of particular relevance here is the practice of recollecting what are known as mental objects, especially the six sense bases and their objects. This aspect of mindfulness involves maintaining a continuous awareness that, as objects impinge upon consciousness via the sense bases or sense organs, various unhealthy mental states arise to intrude on that simple awareness. These unhealthy states, known collectively as the hindrances, include moods and thoughts of lust, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt. Each, in its own way, clouds the essential lightness and clarity of perception. These deep-seated states of mind are a product of our karma, our deluded actions, and they form the very fabric of our self-view, our sense of who we are, and hence what the world is. They are consequently extremely subtle and hard to detect. Mindfulness of one's mental processes is, for this reason, a particularly demanding practice, one that calls for every bit of striving one can muster. Milarepa's sustained awareness of these subtle mental processes has enabled him to detect the arising of the fetter of self-view, the delusion that he is a fixed, separate entity, even as he is grasping desperately at his few remaining possessions, his robe and a few sticks of firewood. Indeed, it is as at such a moment of instinctive reaction that this fetter will force itself into view, even though it is also at just such a moment that mindfulness is most likely to be lost. Milarepa's mindfulness consists in seeing how, when the senses come into contact with their objects, any one of the hindrances may arise. Once we are able to refine consciousness to the extent that we can be aware of these subtle mental comings and goings, we then have only to understand deeply enough the significance of what we see to take the appropriate action. This calls for vigilant and unremitting practice. The hindrances do not arise with any great fanfare. On the contrary, they are extremely subtle. It is the very small things that give them away, and it is these we have to look out for in other people and in ourselves. This is as much as can be asked of anybody. We cannot be expected to be perfect all the time, or even much of the time. All we are invited to do is to stay awake, to keep watch over ourselves, especially with respect to small, seemingly insignificant things that we do, or say, or think, or feel, and to take in the implications of what we notice. The task is to recognize what your observation tells you about yourself, and then to do whatever you need to do to adjust your attitude and bring it more into line with the way things really are. The importance of mindfulness is reflected in the fact that, at least according to one tradition, the Buddha's last words to his disciples were, "With mindfulness, strive." In Pali, that's appamadena sampadesa. It is as though just these two things are expected of us and encapsulate everything we need to do. Know what you are doing, pay attention to every last detail of your existence as it occurs. Take note of every detail of your experience as it impinges upon your consciousness, especially those details that others will probably miss. And if you notice any vestige of anything unskillful, any attachment, any impulse that is mine, this is due to me, take immediate action to change your attitude. The whole procedure is less complicated than it may sound. Milarepa manages to do it in the moment between his brief tussle with the elements and his blackout. But though it is simple and quick, its effects are truly momentous. Near the end of this story, Milarepa comes to the conclusion that a demon was behind the storm, But why does he infer this? It may be difficult for us to imagine the power of a storm in the mountains of Tibet. When I lived in the Himalayan town of Kalimpong, there was once an earth tremor that made the two-story house in front of which I was standing actually jump a couple of inches. It was as though the whole mountain jumped. When we are exposed to the elements in this way, we get a salutary reminder of the insignificance of human intentions as far as those powers, however we interpret them, are concerned. One has only to experience the full force of such elemental powers, whether of storm, volcano, or earthquake, to begin to see the traditional belief that demons are behind those natural phenomena in a different light, unprotected by the paraphernalia of modern civilization. We realize that we are at the mercy of natural forces beyond our control. But here this storm is not to be taken entirely literally. Demon-created and apparently out of control, its fury and clamour are metaphors for the raging whirlwind of ego-clinging that makes our progress through this brief life of ours so very difficult and painful. Yet, unlike the storms of the physical world, this tempest can be stilled if we know how to go about it. By bringing the subtle, almost imperceptible practice of mindfulness to the storm of our ego-clinging, we can eventually tame this demonic force. In Milarepa's case, just one moment of insight into the true nature of mind has caused the storm to abate, the demon of worldly clinging to vanish. His practice of mindfulness and insight continues when he comes around and finds himself lying naked on the ground. He has evidently been unconscious for a while because the storm is over, but the first thing he sees is a shred of his robe in the branches of a tree, fluttering in the now gentle breeze. Again, he is able to see the situation with clarity and creativity. What strikes him is its absurdity. It is as though that shred of clothing, the last thing he possessed, represents all worldly attachments. In a mere shred of cloth, he sees all worldly things, everything that one could cling to: wealth, possessions and pleasures, friends, family and connections, appearance, status, and achievements. He sees that they are all liable to be taken away from us at any time. They can all just blow away. Milarepa's practice of Mahamudra is quite closely related to Zen, and his moment of insight is a little reminiscent of some of the stories of the Zen masters, in which a very simple, apparently insignificant incident sparks off a deep realization. A monk, say, is meditating in the middle of the forest when he sees a single yellow leaf fall, and in that one moment gains insight into the transitory nature of all conditioned things. There is even a Jataka tale in a similar vein. The Jatakas are the traditional folk tales about the Buddha's previous lives. A king is having his hair and beard trimmed when he notices that the combing and snipping stops for a moment while the barber picks out a hair. "What are you doing?" he says, and the barber replies, "It is your first grey hair, sir. Look." The king gazes at that one grey hair, and then he gets up from his comfortable chair, throws off his fine clothes, and walks straight out of the palace into the forest to become a wandering monk. In that single hair he saw everything: old age, disease, and death, the end of all his worldly possessions. Milarepa's response to this realization is to sit down and meditate. As he does so, a cluster of white clouds rises from the valley to the east, above the temple of his guru, Marpa, whom he imagines teaching there his other disciples, Milarepa's, as it were, brothers. There seems to be a suggestion here that with the appearance of the cluster of white clouds, something is happening, whether in physical form or as a vision, as the fruit of Milarepa's practice of the Guru Yoga, the formal visualization and veneration of his teacher. The clouds certainly serve to connect Milarepa's thoughts to his guru. Milarepa desperately misses his guru. The profound spiritual connection between them is not enough for him in his present mood. What follows is a song of devotion to Marpa and of longing for human contact with him. Milarepa wants to see his guru, face to face, in the flesh. He also misses Marpa's wife and his fellow disciples. Milarepa's song. Though limited in reverence, I wish to see you. Though weak in faith, I wish to join you. The more I meditate, the more I long for my guru. Does your wife, Dagmema, still dwell with you? To her I am more grateful than to my mother. How happy I would be could I join the gathering at which you may be teaching the Heivajra Tantra. Though short my diligence, I have need for learning. Though poor my perseverance, I wish to practice. The more I contemplate, the more I think of you. The more I meditate, the more I think of my guru. The brothers from Wu and Sang may be there. If so, I would be joyful and happy. Though inferior my experience and realization, I wish to compare mine with theirs. Devotion to the guru is fundamental to tantric practice. Indeed, this episode begins, as do all the episodes of the collected Songs of Milarepa, with an expression of devotion and worship, obeisance to all gurus, which is meant to remind us of the source of the teachings. This salutation asserts the primacy of personal oral teaching over mere book learning within the school of Tibetan Buddhism that takes its name from this overriding emphasis, the kagyu or whispered transmission, the lineage to which Milarepa belongs. In other words, we are being warned that a text, any text, is not enough for our practical spiritual purposes. The brothers for whom Milarepa longs are his Vajra brothers, his fellow trainees who have received initiation from the same guru. The term signals the importance of the relationship between them. Having the same Vajracharya or tantric path and the same Vajra guru or tantric guru creates an especially close bond with special responsibilities. Harmony is of tremendous significance in such a close-knit spiritual community. And to dispute with your Vajra brother is very damaging, spiritually speaking. As each of you has dedicated yourself to the same ideal and the same path, if you quarrel with a Dharma brother, you are quarrelling with your own commitment. Milarepa naturally entitles his song Thoughts of My Guru. However, there is a suggestion that he feels his separation from his Vajra brothers even more intensely. The language in the final verse is painfully strong. If he misses his Vajra brothers more than his guru, it is not because of any lack of devotion to Marpa. It is because they are more on his level. They are able to offer a kind of straightforward human companionship that he cannot get from someone he reveres so much. As he says, he can compare his experience with theirs, measure himself against them. He may be in some spiritual contact with his Vajra brothers through keeping them in mind, but it is clearly not enough to overcome his sense of isolation. Milarepa can at least practice the guru visualization as a means of getting close to his teacher. But as far as I know, there is no tantric practice in which you visualize your Vajra brothers. But even if there were such a practice, it still wouldn't be enough. You would still want to meet up with them, to talk with them, to have tangible personal contact. And this is Milarepa's experience. He still feels the physical separation, the acute and pressing need for simple, straightforward human company, and he prays to his guru to relieve him of the pain this need gives him. It is easy to lose heart at a time like this, when you have put in a lot of work and get nothing but pain and loneliness in return. Having been sent into the mountains to meditate on his own, Milarepa misses a sense of the spiritual community's support of his individual endeavour. Marpa and his disciples no doubt do comprise a true spiritual community, but it seems that in his darker moments, Milarepa cannot always see them in that light. For all his conscious aspiration to the contrary, at least for the time being, he is seeing the spiritual community not as a spiritual community, but as a group from whose warmth and companionship he feels excluded. And he is seeing himself not as an individual, but as a member of that group. Samuel Johnson, the great 18th century English critic, lexicographer and conversationalist, once said that the reason for his attachment to human company was his fear that the melancholy that descended upon him when he was alone would drive him mad. In this sort of state, it isn't exactly a friend you seek, even if a friend will serve your purpose, but simply someone to distract you from your experience of separateness. Not that the presence of another person will necessarily do this. After all, it is not physical solitude that engenders loneliness, but mental isolation, which the mere physical proximity of others can never completely eradicate. To some extent, such loneliness is inherent in conditioned existence. The very fact of one's subjectivity, that one has a sense of ego or separate self, means that one will always feel, to some extent, cut off from others. The mere fact that others are others means that you are isolated and therefore experience loneliness. If you are sufficiently mindful, you will notice that subtle sense of loneliness in your experience all the time, even, perhaps particularly, when you are with a good friend. The better you know someone and the more time you spend with them, the more you realize they are fundamentally different and ultimately separate from you. They think differently from you. They don't really penetrate into your thoughts, nor do you ever quite succeed in seeing things from their point of view. In the end, you don't understand how it feels to be them, nor can they understand how it feels to be you. So although you may live for years side by side with someone who is very dear to you, your very closeness may help you to see that you are really on your own. This is the kind of insight that can emerge from being aware and mindful when you are with another person. There can be warmth and companionship, but no amount of good friendship can or should alleviate the existential loneliness of conditioned existence. If companionship does help you to forget it, that isn't really a good thing. We should not expect from others more than they're able to give. True spiritual fellowship fosters communication in its most mature sense, mutual responsiveness across a chasm. Even though you share a heartfelt ideal, you are both aware that as long as there is a sense of separate selfhood, you will always feel an element of loneliness when you are on your own and even when you are with a friend. Indeed, it is your shared ideal that reminds you of that chasm between you. The more that knowledge is implicit in your communication, the more effective the communication will be. If you are in a reasonably positive state of mind, such an insight will be exhilarating rather than depressing. A good friend is someone with whom you can be alone. Milarepa sang, "Though inferior my experience and realization, I wish to compare mine with theirs." In expressing a wish to compare his experience with that of his Vajra brothers, Milarepa makes reference to an aspect of the spiritual community that might seem inimical to harmony, that of comparing one's progress with others. Competition, however, is not always a bad thing, even in the spiritual community. Measuring yourself against others, testing your strength of body or mind against others, is a healthy impulse. It is important not just for the individual, but for the social group, and it is good for everyone, even those who come off worst in the contest. Competitiveness drives you to strive for as high a place as possible within the hierarchy of the group to which you belong, and through that struggle you find not only your place in the hierarchy, but also your natural level of competence. You need to compete in order to discover how to make the best use of your abilities. If you have the ability to be a leader, you will naturally work your way up the hierarchy to occupy that position. Indeed, it is essential for the survival of the group and the species as a whole that you do so. Power hierarchies seem to have arisen originally in hunter-gatherer societies, primarily among the males, and their survival value is obvious. If the group is to be organized to defend itself from attack by other groups, it is in everyone's interests that the strongest and cleverest members should take the lead. A normal, healthy male thus has a drive to find out where he stands in relation to other men. And when you get a lot of men together, there is invariably a tendency for the young bulls to challenge the old bull. What you end up with is a power structure, and ideally, if this structure is established by open competition, it will reflect the comparative strength and skill, as well as the shrewdness and cunning of the individuals within it. This basic drive has little to do with the spiritual life, except that any spiritual development has to begin with a healthy human individual. Maintaining the hierarchy of power through competitiveness is useful for many practical purposes and in any situation where a clear objective needs to be achieved. In large projects in particular, it may be impractical to give everyone an equal voice in forming every decision. But a hierarchy of power should not be confused with the spiritual hierarchy. Someone who is physically weak and not particularly bright or ambitious in an ordinary way may still have the drive to keep going on the spiritual path when strong men fall by the wayside. Confusion can easily arise because a hierarchy of power is readily apparent to everyone, whereas a spiritual hierarchy is not. Moreover, there are always practical organizational goals to be achieved, even within the context of the spiritual community. It may be that some people like to get things done through hierarchical structures, while others prefer working in close cooperation on a more or less equal basis. This may mean that certain people end up taking charge of large spiritual institutions, while others tend to be involved in smaller situations. Such arrangements do not imply any spiritual superiority or inferiority on the part of the individuals concerned. Within the context of the spiritual community, the hierarchy of power is to be regarded as instrumental and provisional only. Someone who occupies a higher place within the structure is not thereby more integrated, more developed as a person, more of an individual. For some people, being first in line or being the centre of things is so important that they can be thrown into a very negative mental state when that petty ambition is thwarted, and the spiritual community is by no means exempt from this. This is why the usual Buddhist convention is that when a number of people are to be ordained or initiated, they line up in order of natural seniority, the eldest or the longest standing disciple going first. This avoids any dispute. So long as there is genuine friendship, competitiveness within the spiritual community is generally harmless and even sometimes useful from a practical point of view. But it should be competitiveness of a playful kind. And the more spiritually developed you are, the less you will mind where you find yourself in the hierarchy. You will just step quietly and unobtrusively into the position that your qualities, or lack of them, warrant. In Milarepa's case, his qualities have led him to this desolate spot, many miles away from his companions in the spiritual life, although he is not yet quite reconciled to this state of affairs. But that is about to change. Milarepa's sincere faith in his guru finally brings him the answer he seeks. Although they are physically separated, his guru reveals himself in a vision, riding a lion. Manjushri, the archetypal bodhisattva of wisdom, is usually depicted riding a lion, so the fact that Marpa appears in the same way suggests that he is a manifestation of the wisdom aspect of the Dharma. In any case, his message is entirely reasonable. Rather than reminding Milarepa of what will happen if he doesn't pull himself together, and what rewards await him if he does, Marpa simply reminds him how far he has come. Marpa says, "Have you not continually offered service to the Guru and to the three precious ones above? Have you not dedicated your merits to sentient beings in the six realms? Have not you yourself reached that state of grace in which you can purify your sins and achieve merits?" He draws Milarepa's attention to the positive aspects of his own experience, to the progress he knows he has already made. If his practice has had any beneficial results, then Milarepa has the firm basis he needs for faith in his continuing path. Marpa's appearance in this way is reminiscent of the earth goddess who, according to the traditional accounts, appeared at a similarly critical moment in the Buddha's life, when the Buddha-to-be, Siddhartha, is being assailed by Mara. Mara doubts Siddhartha's right to sit on the Vajrasana, the diamond throne that only a Buddha-to-be can occupy. But the earth goddess arises to bear witness to the depth of Siddhartha's practice, to remind him of the long road he has travelled over many lifetimes to arrive at this place. Becoming conscious of the positive outcome of his dedicated practice of mindfulness and devotion, even though it appears to have led him only to this lonely and desolate mountain, Milarepa has the intelligence to see that, on the basis of what he has already experienced, the practices will eventually bear fruit. They will support you if you will commit yourself to them. If you will only jump into the air, the force of gravity can be relied upon to work. The three jewels will do their bit if you do yours. They are always there. That is why they're called refuges. When you go for refuge to them, they will never fail. Milarepa sings, "My earnest song, called Thoughts of My Guru, must surely have been heard by you, my teacher. Yet am I still in darkness. Pray pity me and grant me your protection." Indomitable perseverance is the highest offering to my guru. The best way to please him is to endure the hardship of meditation. Abiding in this cave alone is the noblest service to the Dakinis. Guru mine, pray grant me your protection. Help this mendicant to stay ever in his hermitage. The song shows Milarepa's mettle, even in his moment of weakness. He is effectively saying, "What else have I got?" He is still, as he says, in darkness, but he does not entreat Marpa to be gentle with him, to indulge his simple and innocent human yearning for the company of like-minded people. Instead, he asks his guru to help him persevere on the path set out for him. He sees that he must seek inspiration in the very hardship that seems to be drying up his inspiration. There is no way back, and he does not ask for one. This resurgence of faith in the path is enough to lift his flagging spirits. His inspiration returns, and his energies are again aroused. Text. Exalted, Milarepa adjusted his robe and carried a handful of wood back to his cave. Inside, he was startled to find 5 Indian demons with eyes as large as saucers. One was sitting on his bed and preaching. 2 were listening to the sermon. Another was preparing and offering food. And the last was studying Milarepa's books. Following his initial shock, Milarepa thought, "These must be magical apparitions of the local deities who dislike me. Although I have been living here a long time, I have never given them any offering or compliment." From this passage, it would seem that Milarepa has retrieved both his robe and the wood he has collected. But here is another shock, perhaps even more disconcerting than the storm. His cave has suddenly become a little crowded. 5 demons have arrived, apparently for an extended visit. They are Indian demons rather than the homegrown Tibetan variety, so they are all the more strange and terrifying. Milarepa's initial thought is that these demons are the local gods or spirits, irritated at having been ignored and appearing in malevolent form in order to frighten him into offering them some respect. He has overlooked the need to pay homage to them to make offerings, show appreciation of their prior claim on the place where he now wants to practice. He needs to placate them so that they do not disturb his meditation. A local deity is the power of a particular area, literally the spirit of the place in a personalized form. It isn't just a mental response to the place, it is a perceptible presence. This is the difference between a modern experience of place and a traditional view. It is a universal human trait even today to personalize inanimate objects like ships and cars. People often have a kind of relationship with such things, involving affection and respect. We can also find ourselves reacting with irritation to the apparent malevolence of a gust of wind that blows away a hat, or a chair that gets in the way, or a car that won't start. But for modern, urban, rationalistic people, that is as far as our personalizing tendencies go. We tend to see the environment as an arrangement of more or less inanimate objects, interrelated by various physical processes. But we should not regard this modern attitude as in any sense normal. In a pre-modern culture, one's surroundings were always straightforwardly alive. Local deities are the literal personification of the psychic atmosphere of particular locations and natural objects, like trees. In Pali texts, for example, one comes across tree divinities who start speaking to one or another of the monks, perhaps rebuking him or encouraging him in his meditation. Such spirits are common in the folklore of primitive cultures. It is as though primitive people, I don't mean to imply any disparagement by the use of the term primitive, have a great sensitivity to the psychic atmosphere of a particular spot and a tendency to experience it in personal terms as a spirit or divinity of some kind. Many primitive peoples establish their whole religious culture upon these perceptions. Wherever they are, whether in the middle of a desert or forest, or by a stream or gully, they sense someone there and regard this being or entity as the local deity. If you want to refer to a particular local atmosphere, the general effect that a region or place has on the psyche, you speak of the god or goddess of that tract of land or forest or cave or shrine. A certain numinous atmosphere becomes concentrated into a particular form or figure, so that the atmosphere of a place is someone rather than something. Without necessarily seeing or hearing anything, you feel a kind of presence. My friend and teacher, Yogi Chen, a Chan and Vajrayana practitioner who used to live in a little bungalow near the bazaar in Kalimpong, used to tell me endless stories of his own encounters with gods and goddesses and other such beings, including these local deities. When I went to see him, he might say, for example, "Just before you arrived, such and such a deity came and told me what I was to say to you." This sort of remark used to give me food for thought. I knew him well enough not to doubt his sincerity, and it was not a decision on his part to express his experience in these terms. This was the truth of his experience, however one might try to evaluate it. These beings were completely real to him, as real as the people who came to see him, if not more so. His was perhaps the most extreme case of this way of seeing that I have been closely associated with, though I have known other people whose experience was similar. It is as though such people are psychically organized to experience things in this way. It's rather like the way children experience things. They literally see forms and figures, not physically, but with an inner eye, and they may even hear voices. This is how they experience what most of us would describe in more impersonal terms as the atmosphere of a place. Modern Westerners, who find themselves susceptible to this way of experiencing the influence of a place, tend to get on well with meditation, especially meditation of a visionary or devotional kind. But there are some places in Britain, Glastonbury, for example, that retain such a strong atmosphere that most people can feel it. Explain it how you will, you can feel an unusual quality in the very air of the place. And to speak of the local deity is probably the simplest and most straightforward way of referring to this. If you are receptive enough, you can pick up some unseen quality in many places, perhaps particularly in woods and ancient forests. Nor is the psychic atmosphere of such places always benign. At a place in England where I used to go on retreat, I noticed a distinct atmosphere among the trees nearby. Other people noticed it too, and found the forest a frightening place to be. The trees seemed angry and resentful, perhaps because they were planted so close together. Like people stuck on a congested train, they didn't have enough space. A nearby airfield may also have contributed to their discomfort. The noise from the planes flying low overhead cannot have been good for their nerves. But whatever the reason for this unpleasant atmosphere, it was not just a poetic fancy on my part. I felt it quite directly. Those trees didn't like human beings. They weren't pleased to see me. By contrast, the woods near our retreat centre in Norfolk, Pabaloka, seem very happy. It must have made quite a psychological difference to the monks of the Buddha's time that they lived out their lives under trees. Northern India was one great forest at the time and is referred to as such in the Pali texts. The Pali term is Mahavana. The monks slept in the forest, they walked along narrow tracks through it, and they begged for alms in villages surrounded by it. Of course, since the Buddha's time, many forests have been cut down, and humanity has lost the company of very many trees. One can only speculate as to the effect of this loss on the human psyche, but perhaps it is significant that even in the most industrial of cities, the city planners have felt the need to plant trees along the streets and in the parks. One can imagine that the effect of living in an environment populated by large numbers of animals would be similarly noticeable. On the plains of Africa, the presence of enormous flocks and herds must give one a strong sensation of being a member of a single species among many, many others, part of a whole complex of living beings, the vast majority of which are non-human. Where humans do not dominate, we perhaps become aware of different psychic forces than those we are used to, and aware of ourselves as belonging to just another species of animal. At the same time, we see the gulf between ourselves and these other forms of life and the specific significance of human life, and we feel our need for the companionship of other human beings. In the end, the experience of other forms of life may bring us back to an appreciation of our own kind, of those with whom we can communicate most fully. It is not, after all, as if there is an absence of nature in towns and cities. It is more that nature is present in a particular form, that of an overwhelming preponderance of human beings, producing an extraordinary range of psychic energies. Even towns and cities have their local deities. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, for example, the Buddha is described as arriving at a certain spot, Patalingama, near the modern Patna, and prophesying that one day a great city would be built there. Apparently, he detected the kind of powerful deities that incite men's minds to build cities rather than, say, meditate. Even today, at the feet of the high-rise apartment blocks of modern Hong Kong or Bangkok, you will find shrines to the local gods, with incense burning and perhaps a few flowers as offerings. Our usual experience of nature, the countryside as we call it in England, is another thing altogether. Domesticated and cultivated, the countryside is less intensely stimulating, less inhabited in this sense of psychic presences, than either the city or nature in the wild. The significant point to be drawn from Milarepa's encounter with these demons, however, is that the Buddhist ideal is to adopt a friendly attitude towards all such deities, whether they appear as benign spirits or as malignant demons. It is true that the teacher who is credited with establishing Buddhism in Tibet, Padmasambhava, is commonly said to have achieved this by subduing the local demons. But this terminology may be a little misleading, suggesting, as it does, an aggressive suppression of malignant spirits. In fact, the word demon, in the sense of the word devil, is a purely Christian usage of the Greek daemon, meaning a presiding genius or tutelary deity. Far from suppressing these powerful forces, Padmasambhava harnessed their energies, putting them at the service of the Dharma. The Buddha himself always insisted on respecting the local gods and religious traditions, and when the figure of the Buddha first became an object of worship, he was depicted with major gods from the Hindu pantheon waiting upon him. One image, for example, shows him descending from the Devaloka, or heaven realms, attended by Indra and Brahma. The old gods are thus not excluded, but given their place in a greater scheme. The ethnic is integrated with the universal, the lower religious ideal with the higher spiritual and transcendental ideal. If this integration does not take place in some way, trouble will ensue, for these strange forces are not as alien as they seem. Their existence is, to some extent, bound up with our own. The energies that find their expression in the form of the spirits and demons that appear in the folklore of indigenous culture also emerge as aspects of ourselves, and these basic energies cannot just be put to one side and ignored. You could perhaps do so if you were enlightened, The Buddha's enlightened disciple Sariputra famously managed to ignore the violent attentions of a malignant demon completely on one occasion, as observed by his friend Moggallana and recorded in the Pali Canon. But if we are not enlightened, these energies have to be harnessed, directed, assimilated, absorbed, which may mean bringing local deities into line. In folkloric terms, the demons have to be subdued. So if you're going to build a Buddhist temple in England, it is probably a mistake to build a replica of a Tibetan or Japanese building. You would first need to find a location that had already a positive atmosphere. Then you could introduce into the construction of the temple certain motifs or decorative touches with an indigenous significance. In place of Bodhi leaves carved into the wooden beams, you could have oak leaves with all the associations that they embody for the English: Druids, mistletoe, the protective wooden walls of the Royal Navy, hearts of oak, strength, stability, and so on. And in this way, you would, to some extent, incorporate the energies of the local culture into your spiritual purposes. All those associations would contribute their energies to the ideals to which the temple was dedicated, and gradually more and more features of the local culture could be brought in to support your spiritual aims. So Milarepa sings a complimentary song to the demons in an attempt to charm them into leaving him alone. He lets them know that he has taken a bodhisattva vow and that therefore he wishes them well. The text: ye local demons, gods and ghosts, all friends of Milarepa, drink the nectar of kindness and compassion, then return to your abodes. But the Indian demons did not vanish and stared balefully at Milarepa. Two of them advanced, one grimacing and biting his lower lip, and the other grinding his teeth horribly. A third, coming up behind, gave a violent, malicious laugh and shouted loudly. Clearly the demons are not inclined to avail themselves of Milarepa's offer of the nectar of kindness and compassion. They are certainly not at all charmed. Realizing that this attempt to appease them has failed, Milarepa tries a different tactic. Delivering a powerful incantation, he calls on his higher energies to confront these dark forces that have invaded his practice. In doing this, he is flexing his spiritual muscles, as it were. Why, after all, should a fervent devotee of the Buddha himself have anything to fear from mere demons? The demons must surely acknowledge that they have been beaten in a straight fight. But no, they remain unmoved. Seeing that he is on entirely the wrong track with them, Milarepa tries to put things right with a compassionate lesson in Buddhist doctrine. Nonetheless, the demons obstinately stay put. In hindsight, it is obvious why this ploy fails. It fails because it is a ploy. His motive in preaching the Dharma is not the spiritual welfare of the demons. The Dharma may indeed involve great compassion, but in this case it is not his own. As he has recourse to great compassion only when the wrathful Buddha meditation fails, it is not even ordinary compassion. He tries to get rid of them by force, and when that fails, he tries to get rid of them by kindness, but his attitude remains the same. The demons seem to have made themselves quite cosy in Milarepa's cave. But why do they present a scene of such studied domesticity? It seems an odd way for Indian demons to behave. The answer is that they are a particular kind of demon, best described not as spirits of place, but as pretas, or hungry ghosts. Pretas are embodiments of craving or neurotic desire, hence their eyes like saucers, and the scene they are enacting is a kind of ghastly parody of the spiritual community for which Milarepa has been yearning. Suddenly, Milarepa realizes what is going on. He has misread the nature of these demons, taking them to be unfriendly local spirits, the neighborhood thugs of the spirit world, when they are in fact something much closer to home. They are a kind of emanation of Milarepa's state of mind, of his praetor-like longing to be supported in his weakness, to be distracted and comforted by the warmth and companionship of his Vajra brothers. His craving turns the spiritual community, in his own mind, into a collection of hungry ghosts, gathered together out of neurotic craving. In his heart of hearts, this is what Milarepa wants, perhaps what we all want, but until now he has not understood that this is the case, so the demons have remained. There is nothing wrong with the positive human group. One needs the support and encouragement of like-minded companions. But the true spiritual community is more than that. It means more than sharing a psychologically healthy lifestyle, more than satisfying the simple human desire for contact and warmth under the guise of engagement in spiritual practice. The demons represent aspects of Milarepa's own unsubdued ego, which takes the form of a subtle clinging to his identity as a member of the religious group. And you cannot get rid of ego with ego, even if that egotism takes up a wrathful Buddha meditation or gives a teaching on compassion to do it. He has been trying to rid himself of these unpleasant manifestations by force of will, when all he had to do was see their true nature. In biblical language, it is like trying to cast out Satan with the fire of Satan. As long as you are wrestling with the devil, you will not get rid of him. If you fight against the forces of evil as if they were really out there ranged against you, you will only magnify your egotism. But if you recognize the devil, in Buddhist terms, as Mara, you just have to see through him, to see him as a state of your own mind. After all, Milarepa says to himself, I'm supposed to have seen through to the essential reality common to all things. I am void, the demons are void. Who is trying to get rid of what? So he sings his song of realization. Father Guru, who conquered the four demons, I bow to you, Marpa the translator. I, whom you see, the man with the name, son of Dasengamo, was nurtured in my mother's womb, completing the three veins. A baby, I slept in my cradle. A youth, I watched the door. A man, I lived on a high mountain. Though the storm on the snow peak is awesome, I have no fear. Though the precipice is steep and perilous, I am not afraid. I, whom you see, the man with the name, am a son of the golden eagle. I grew wings and feathers in the egg. A child, I slept in my cradle. A youth, I watched the door. A man, I flew in the sky. Though the sky is high and wide, I do not fear. Though the way is steep and narrow, I am not afraid. I, whom you see, the man with the name, am a son of Nya Chen Yomo, the king of fishes. In my mother's womb I rolled my golden eyes. A child I slept in my cradle. A youth I learned to swim. A man I swam in the great ocean. Though thundering waves are frightening, I do not fear. Though fishing hooks abound, I am not afraid. I, whom you see, the man with the name, am a son of Gagyu Lamas. Faith grew in my mother's womb. A baby, I entered the door of Dharma. A youth, I studied Buddha's teaching. A man, I lived alone in caves. Though demons, ghosts, and devils multiply, I am not afraid. The snow lion's paws are never frozen. Or of what use would it be to call the lion king? He who has the three perfect powers. The eagle never falls down from the sky. If so, would that not be absurd? An iron block cannot be cracked by a stone. If so, why refine the iron ore? I, Milarepa, fear neither demons nor evils. If they frightened Milarepa, to what avail would be his realization and enlightenment? You ghosts and demons, enemies of the Dharma, I welcome you today. It is my pleasure to receive you. I pray you stay. Do not hasten to leave. We will discourse and play together. Although you would be gone, stay the night. We will pit the black against the white Dharma and see who plays the best. Before you came, you vowed to afflict me. Shame and disgrace would follow you if you returned with this vow unfulfilled. Distracted first by the storm, then by the demons, Milarepa comes each time to himself again as he reconnects with his realization of the Mahamudra teaching. On each occasion, as a result of remembering his practice, he recognizes himself and sees that his frustrating experience and the demons are not separate from the process of integrating his energies. In introducing himself as the man with a name, Milarepa is effectively recollecting himself. By his name he is known, recognized, recollected. The golden eagle, the snow lion, and the king of fishes are traditional images, and they often appear in Milarepa's songs. Here they serve to elaborate a basic theme, bringing the changes on his original statement. The principle they illustrate is his embodiment of enlightenment, the idea that he has taken on enlightenment as his essential nature, allowing him to live and move in the transcendental realm, as they do in their natural environments. He can no more be frightened of demons than the eagle can fall out of the sky. Not only this, just as the eagle is an eagle in the egg, so Milarepa is who he is, even in his mother's womb, surrounded by the three veins, around which, according to Tibetan tradition, the embryo develops. His faith is not some alien growth. His realization of the void emerges in the process of his natural development. It is integral to what he is, not grafted on later. It seems that when we are quite young, before we get involved in the world socially, economically, and sexually, when we are still fairly innocent, still a spectator, we see the simple reality of things quite clearly. Then for a few years we are led away from that knowledge. We listen to other people and get entangled with them, and we lose touch with our own vision and insight. It may be only in our early 20s or much later that it all starts to come back to us, perhaps slowly and painfully. Indeed, for a long time we may not get far beyond the knowledge we had when we were much younger. There is perhaps a connection between this kind of experience and the Tibetan teaching on the intermediate state, or bardo. It is generally understood in Tibetan Buddhism that when we are in the bardo state, following physical death, bardo means in between, we have opportunities for spiritual attainment that we are not able to assimilate. We have no way of contextualizing them, so we go bouncing down from level to level, until we find some experience with which we are familiar and to which we can respond. Thus we arrive at our next rebirth, back in this world again. However, we have had that vision of reality in between, and there may be some vestige of this, however vague and obscure, lingering on in the early years of our next life. There is an example of this in the life story of the Buddha himself. The traditional accounts describe how, one day, he went to rest in the shade of a rose-apple tree, while his father, the king, conducted a ritual first ploughing of the field in springtime. As the boy rested in the cool shade of the tree, his mind progressed quite naturally through states of increasing clarity and joy into the meditative state known as the first dhyana. At that time, he had no context in which to place his experience, and he forgot it. It was only much later in his life, having left his spiritual teachers and gone to seek enlightenment at the foot of the Bodhi tree, that he found himself recollecting that incident from his boyhood. Regaining a flavour of the spontaneous bliss he had experienced then, he thought, "Is this the way?" And the rest, as they say, is history. One important aspect of this story is that it appears to show that meditative experience is not gained by the forcible application of a particular technique, but unfolds as a natural process of growth and development. Techniques and practices are necessary to assist and guide this process, but it is as though one has to proceed by letting things grow naturally and by encouraging and coaxing that growth, rather than forcing one's development by sheer effort of will. The common sense view of personal development is that we begin life in ignorance and gradually learn more about the nature of things through experience and various kinds of training. The Buddha's experience under the rose apple tree, however, suggests that, from a spiritual point of view, important knowledge goes hand in hand with innocence and is lost with experience, at least with experience of a certain kind. In going out into the world with the aim of gaining wisdom, we are liable to get tangled up in all kinds of things and end up not wiser, but more deluded. Even in the pursuit of spiritual training, it is possible to entrap oneself further in time and place and personality, and in doing so, move still further from true wisdom, the understanding that is altogether beyond time and place and free from personality. Milarepa rushes at the demons and they shrink back in fear, then swirl together and vanish. He is successful in dealing with them this time because he has realized what they really are. He rushes at them not because he has decided to act aggressively, but as an expression of his spiritual power, which in turn expresses his realization that, in the ultimate sense, there are no demons. There is nothing to be afraid of, and therefore no need to get rid of them. It is nothing to him if they choose to stay. Text. This was the demon king, Vinayakaya, the obstacle maker, who came searching for evil opportunities, thought Milarepa. The storm, too, was undoubtedly his creation. By the mercy of my guru, he had no chance to harm me. It seems that Milarepa's Mahamudra practice and his realization of the mind as a transparency of voidness momentarily deserted him under the shock of being haunted by these hungry ghosts. But the earlier vision of his guru is what eventually recalled him to his experience of the truth of things, enabling him to disarm his visitors. This is presumably what he means by the mercy of my guru. In retrospect, it seems significant that Marpa earlier addressed Milarepa in that vision as the great sorcerer, reminding his disciple of the powers of which he had made use before his conversion. Was Marpa giving him an implicit warning in anticipation of the demonic challenge to come, not to fall back into his old habits? Perhaps he was saying, "You've been meditating all this time in that cave, but aren't you still just a sorcerer trying to gain your end by forcible means? Are you going to carry on imposing yourself on your situation, applying the powers at your disposal, just as in the old days when you worked your will by force of magic?" In the early stages of any spiritual career, there has to be struggle, and Milarepa evidently struggled hard and well. But he has reached an advanced stage where willpower is not the most positive quality to develop. He did fall briefly into his old habits when he attempted to use the Dharma in a kind of power game with the demons in order to rid himself of them. But then, drawing on the depth of his accumulated mindfulness and understanding, he finally saw through them. How do we safeguard the essential wisdom of the Dharma? It may seem as though Milarepa's answer is to avoid human contact at all costs. and hide himself away in the mountains to pursue a life of meditation and abstinence. But the example of his life is not quite what it seems. It appears extreme, outstandingly austere and solitary, perhaps more so even than that of Gautama the Buddha. But he still manages to embody the Mahayana ideal of compassion, of practicing for the sake of others, as conspicuously as any teacher of that tradition. His songs have produced a tremendous effect on many generations of Tibetans, and the joy those songs express, with never a care for his material needs, even for basic food and shelter, must have inspired countless hermits in their own practice. Milarepa's practice and way of life, his solitary, comfortless, but joyful life, is his teaching. He has attained the goal, but that is no reason to abandon the path, because the goal is not in the end separate from that path. Milarepa benefits people by exemplification, by living out the teaching he espouses without any compromise at all. His strength as a practitioner is in his commitment to his chosen path. Even though in principle he could have continued to practice under other conditions, settled in a monastery or even out in the world, he would not have done so by choice. Milarepa sets an inspiring example of transcendental faith and joy, determination and mindful vigilance. But he does not offer a realistically practical lifestyle for us to follow. He lived in a society in which the Buddhist tradition was well established and where its doctrines and practices were widely understood and appreciated. He may have completely disregarded mundane material matters himself, but there were faithful people who would certainly have made his life a little easier, at least from time to time. They would get to hear about him and appreciate the value of what he was doing enough to trudge up the mountain to supply him with food and drink. Unfortunately, such supportive conditions for the life of a hermit are very hard to find in the world today. For one thing, even ostensibly inaccessible places are much busier than they used to be. If you tried to follow Milarepa's example and meditate in a cave in the mountains, or in some relatively uninhabited region, you would be unlikely to find yourself alone for long, given the presence of backpackers and hikers, mountaineers and skiers, explorers and scientists, fossil hunters, naturalists and all the rest. And would all those people, or the local people, appreciate the significance of what you are doing? It may be a weakness of faith on my part, but I'm afraid I would not personally want to rely on the ravens to feed me, or the locals for that matter. They wouldn't be likely to think, "Here's a yogi doing something important," and come trotting along with food and drink. Indeed, if they took any interest in you, they might well report you to the authorities and recommend your detention on the grounds of impaired mental health. So we cannot get away from the world in quite the way Milarepa did. Escape is no longer possible. Escapism, yes, but not escape. Modern societies are not prepared to leave anyone or anything alone. Through our practice of mindfulness, we can go some way towards creating our own internal refuge, but we still have to deal all the time with surroundings that are not conducive to stillness, simplicity, and contentment. For most of us, therefore, Milarepa's example presents not so much a lifestyle to follow as a warning against overconfidence and the danger of abandoning the safeguard of positive conditions prematurely. When you've been on retreat, it can seem very tempting to throw yourself back into worldly life because you feel so full of energy and positivity. You cannot see the threat to your practice from the world around you. You don't see it coming, it just smothers and seduces you until your retreat seems like a distant dream. The message of Milarepa's solitary life is a little reminiscent of a parable in the Pali Canon. The Buddha says that the deer are safe so long as they feed high in the mountains. But when they come down to the fields to nibble the crops, they are liable to be shot. In the same way, he goes on, if monks stray from their ancestral grazing grounds, the pastures of meditation and the solitary life, if they start nibbling at the fringes of worldly life, then Mara is likely to take a pot shot at them. As Buddhists, we need to stay on our own home ground, and that means moving decisively away from the lower pastures of the mountain, where our ideals and aspirations are constantly curbed and compromised by the worldly values that surround us. We need to try, even in the midst of the world, to carve out a specifically Buddhist way of life, a kind of miniature Pure Land, where people can work together, live together, and practice together in ways that do justice to their spiritual aspirations. It might take the form of residential communities or right livelihood businesses, or Buddhist centres dedicated to practicing, communicating, and celebrating the Dharma. They would be places in which spiritual values could be nurtured and allowed to grow, sheltered, at least to some extent, from the inhospitable winds of the mundane world. We cannot expect these situations we set up to offer perfect conditions for practice, any more than those who set them up will be perfectly accomplished practitioners. You cannot bring into existence the perfect Buddhist culture or the mature individuals to nurture it at a stroke. Especially at the beginning, they will be working with the limitations of the group mentality they have inherited. But it will be a start, a necessary beginning. And as those who are able to enjoy such conditions grow and develop spiritually, the conditions will get better, providing greater opportunity for further progress. The very presence of such spiritual oases will have an effect on the surrounding culture. Newcomers will be attracted and inspired, and will want to join in, and in this way, spiritual values will gain ground within worldly society, and be able to sustain a presence there. So the process can go on indefinitely, both in a structural, social sense, and in the sense of new levels of individual progress. However, the spiritual community is not just a structure in which to live and work. It is also concerned with the ways in which individuals associate with each other. Ideally, the social structures we create among ourselves will provide a basis upon which to develop individuality in the truest sense, and certainly not to hold it back. After all, as human beings, we are social animals. The Buddhist path is all about overcoming ego, and collective situations are very good places in which to bring this about. The essential context for spiritual progress is thus the Sangha, or spiritual community. This is the companionship that helps you grow, rather than the group with which you must conform. The Sangha, if it is a real Sangha, provides a collective situation in which you can be honest about your feelings and thoughts, even though sometimes you may need to restrain yourself from acting on them. The middle way of individuality avoids both individualism, in the sense of disregard of others, and a timid, mindless social conformity. Decision-making is the central issue in any collective situation. All too often in everyday life we are faced with decisions that have been made for us, and this is bound to create inner conflict. In the spiritual community, however, you will ideally feel that you can talk about your conflicted feelings. You don't have to pretend you're keen to do something when you're not. If it is a question of preference rather than moral principle, you can even say, well, to be honest, I prefer to do something else, though I don't mind going along with what you want if it's important to you. The principle here is to refrain from insisting on your preference, while feeling free to be honest about what you prefer. In that case, you can go along with what others want, in spite of your own feelings. There's no pretense in that conformity, especially in view of the fact that feelings are evanescent and can change swiftly and genuinely. In the end, you can honestly want to do what the others want to do, even though you originally wanted to do something different. But whatever happens, the collective context has not held you back from the honest expression of your thoughts, nor coerced you into behaving in a certain way in order to avoid condemnation. In this way, our incipient individuality, that is, our willingness to take responsibility for ourselves in self-motivated spiritual endeavour, begins to grow deeper roots. We will be able to protect Buddhist ethical and spiritual values from becoming institutionalised, from serving and perpetuating worldly values, rather than dissolving and transforming them. In time, as a spiritual community develops, contact with wider society will not be as costly to the individual's progress. We will be in a stronger position to deal creatively with the wider world on our own terms. Perhaps, eventually, genuine hermits will be able to follow Milarepa's inspiring example, supported by the wider Sangha. At that point, we will have achieved something closer to the supportive conditions enjoyed by the cotton-clad yogi Milarepa in old Tibet. Traditionally, the going forth from worldly entanglements is an integral part of the going for refuge to the Buddha, his teaching, and the spiritual community. In our own case, the question is not so much whether we can establish a certain preconceived way of life or work, but whether we can surround ourselves with conditions that support our spiritual aspirations. When you step away from the conditions you have inherited, when you go forth, to use the traditional phrase, to pursue the spiritual life, this is not just a shift in your external circumstances. Renunciation as an external act is significant only to the extent that it reflects an inner experience. If you go forth, in whatever way, with a genuine spiritual motivation into a more avowedly Buddhist context, you are moving in the direction of enlightenment. The reaching of this decisive point is a turning away from the group and a turning towards the spiritual community. In the highest sense, the spiritual community is represented by the whole Buddhist tradition, a lineage of gurus and teachers leading all the way up to the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. But in a more everyday sense, and this is where we begin to transform our lives, the spiritual community consists of ordinary men and women who are prepared to struggle with their demons, just as even Milarepa had to do.